first item of business is there was a recall on Senate File 123. That has happened. That Senate file has already been read in. We will not read it in, but Senate File 123, which is School Nutrition Pilot Project, sponsored by Senator Boehner, will be re-referred or be recalled and referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. I'd also like to make an announcement for members of the Senate that tomorrow at noon recess, there will be a tour of the Capitol Project, and it will start 15 minutes after we recess in the House, but ours will be at noon recess. And you should have it on your desk where to meet and everything, and then there will also be a tour February at noon recess for the senators. And especially for the new members or for some of you that have been around a while, I would encourage you to attend that, take a look at what we're doing, what's going on, and be up to speed, because it's quite a project, and I think it'd be very, very beneficial for all of you to be able to go there and take a look at it. And with that, Mr. Majority Floor Leader, with the order of business consideration, reconsideration of bills on general file.
Okay, with that, on that, Mr. President, I move that the Senate re-resolve itself in the Committee of the Whole.
You heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senator Ellis, please come to the podium.
The Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The first bill for our consideration is Senate File 132. The reading clerk will read the Senate file.
Senate File 132, Endow Initiative, an act relating to economic diversification, sponsored by Senator Bebout, was referred to Committee Number 9, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Coe, Perkins, Rothfuss, and Von Flatern. No, Senator Anderson. Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Von Flatern?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 132. There is an amendment. I ask that it be read in at this time.
Will the clerk read the amendment?
Senate File 132, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 11.
I move Standing Committee Number 1 to Senate File 132 and to explain this bill. I ask that you call on Senator President Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. President Bebout.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Members of the Senate, I bring you Senate File 132. It's the Endow Initiative. And, Madam Chairman, what I'm going to do is go through the bill and parts of the bill and then come back to the Standing Committee Amendment after I've had a chance to discuss the bill a little bit more, and we'll plug that in and see how that proceeds. Madam Chairman, there's been a lot of discussion in our state over the history of our state, quite frankly, about economic diversification, and I've been around a while in the legislature, and, you know, when we have the bust period, we always seem to talk about it, then the boom comes back and never quite gets done. And you could pick up a paper and you could read the headlines that says that revenues are down, you know, school funding shortfalls exist, jobs have been lost. This could have been a headline that happened many times in the history of our great state. Those headlines occur. We make an effort in the terms of the legislative process, working with the executive branch to try to diversify. And usually they're short-term efforts, and before we get a chance to get much done, the cycle comes back and we're off again, and we really don't get it done to the level that we want to. So that's why we bring to you Senate File 132, Madam Chairman, to really have a longer-term look at truly trying to diversify our economy. And all of you were present when the governor spoke in his State of the State address, and he made a big point to talk about the Endow Initiative. And of course, the governor has been working very diligently on this with your legislative leadership. And I think it's a step in the right direction, Madam Chairman. What I'll do is I'll go through the bill fairly quickly. I'm sure all of you have had a chance to read it. And then I'll be glad to answer questions, and then we can work on the Standing Committee Amendment. You know, the first part of the bill is something that I usually don't have a lot of credence in nor support, is that a legislative finding. However, I think in this particular case, it was important to include the legislative finding section and to talk about what we find and what we're trying to do, which is, of course, develop a long-term 20-year comprehensive and coordinated economic diversification strategy. And that's what the findings say. And if you go to page 3 and you look specifically at lines 4 through 6, the thing I think is very important in our finding, it's a coordinated approach between the legislative and executive branches of government. Then we go on down, which is really the guts of the bill, Madam Chairman, on page 3, line 16. This act creates an executive council supported by the governor's office to oversee and promote these efforts. Turn to the next page. We get into the new statutes that we create, Madam Chairman, and the first one is under 912.1401. We talk about what ENDOW stands for, and ENDOW is the Economically Needed Diversity Options for Wyoming. And, Madam Chairman, I don't know if we said the word endowed and tried to figure out what words to put in there to correlate with that, or it just happened to work out that way, but it's one of those acronyms. It's a good catch title. And the whole thing about it that's so important, Madam Chairman, if you look down on line 13, it's 15 voting members of this council. And this council is really talking about the private sector. It's private sector driven. It's from people in Wyoming that understand our state, understand business, understand the complexity of trying to do business on our state, and also understand what we need to do in terms of trying to diversify our economy. We thought it was really important to have the Senate and House Minerals, Business, and Economic Development Committees involved in that, and they're ex officio, Madam Chairman, so they'll be the chair of each one of those will be non-voting members of this. You go on to the next page, and it talks about the appointment of those and how they're doing it and what the governor does in terms of that diversification component. Not more than two members shall be served concurrently from the same economic subsector. It sort of talks about how we set up the framework for the membership. They will not receive any compensation, Madam Chairman. You go to page 6, and you look at the, starting with line 5, this council shall be administered by the office of the governor. And Madam Chairman, what this bill does not include is any more state employees. If there's nobody else in the governor's office, he will have to use existing staff to administer this. And then this is an important part of it. It will be supported by the Wyoming Business Council, the Community College Commission, University of Wyoming, and Department of Workforce Services. Madam Chairman, when we talk to people about, you know, not only diversifying our economy, but coming to Wyoming and working here, plus all the existing businesses we have, a big part of it is the educational and having a workforce that's qualified to do that. That's why we have the community colleges, UW, and Department of Workforce Services involved. Then the other thing, Madam Chairman, we put in, I think, is very important, is on page 6, line 16, business development innovation zones. You know, a lot of you have heard us talk about the Heartland Institute, and our neighbors to the north in Canada were able to set aside a large section of land that had a lot of different factors that were needed to help that particular center diversify and add value to those tremendous minerals they had. They have the water, they have the electricity, natural gas. We're talking about setting up a similar situation in Wyoming where obviously we could put our water to beneficial use, utilize our gas and our low cost of electricity to try to do these particular zones. And when we talk about these, Madam Chairman, we're talking about like petrochemical plants, other ways to add value to our tremendous natural resources. You know, there's ways we can maybe add value to Trona down in southwestern Wyoming, some of those kind of issues. Then the thing we wanted to do, Madam Chairman, is rather than just say we're going to look at this for 20 years and sort of turn the executive branch loose, we wanted to put some qualifiers in there so we know what's going on. And the first one of those occurs at the bottom of 7. By August 30th of this year, if this bill should pass, that we want them to submit to the governor and the Joint Minerals Committee an exhaustive assessment of the, and you can read it at the top of page 9, the socioeconomic data existing new and emerging economic sectors and subsectors of our economy. It sort of lays a frame for what's going on in Wyoming, what we see, what we don't see, what it looks like. And then further on page 8, Madam Chairman, line 9, by December 31st of this year, we prepare and submit to the governor and legislature a report of its preliminary findings and recommendations. The purpose of this, Madam Chairman, is to not only know what's been going on since we looked at the exhaustive assessment of where we are, but what's a preliminary plan and what we might do. The other thing this would allow us to do, Madam Chairman, it will be in session in February of the next year, and if there's some legislation we need to do, that we could in fact do that. You go on to page 9, Madam Chairman, line 14, and here we ask by August 1st of 2018, prepare and submit to the governor his approval a 20-year comprehensive economic diversification strategy. And the key here, members of the Senate, is to realize that we have these 15 private sector people that understand Wyoming working with the co-chairs of the Minerals Committee to have a long-term strategy. And that's what that particular sidebar would do. Then further on page 10, we wanted to do this every 4 years so we have an action plan rather than just, hey, here's our 20-year strategy and let it be on the shelf and something we don't pay attention to. We're going to talk about every 4 years, see where we stand. The rest of the bill, page 11, 12, 13, it talks about some of the inner workings of it, and I don't think we necessarily need to go to those. I'll be glad to answer any questions. We get to page 13, line 2, as part of what we shall do is develop a performance evaluation system to monitor the progress and report to the governor the status of what we're trying to do. And the last thing on that particular thing under shall, Madam Chairman, on page 13, line 8, in carrying out his duties under this article, the governor, in consultation with the presiding officers of the legislature, may convene advisors to obtain objective advice in the formulation of this plan. Madam Chairman, what this really says is that we're going to have our 15 private sector people along with the co-chair of the minerals. We're also going to allow the governor to, if he sees fit, to bring in other high-level officials that may want to locate a petrochemical plant here or nuclear, something to do with the nuclear industry, and that the presiding officers of the legislature would work with those people to try to move that forward. Also, then, on page 13, we talk about the governor shall designate a coordinator of economic diversification who shall be a qualified elector, and this coordinator shall provide administrative support for Endow, and it goes through the list of things that coordinator would do and how it would work with, it. Once again, the Wyoming Business Council, Community College, University of Wyoming, Department of Workforce Services. It goes on, further delineates that on page 15. And then we create on page 15, the bottom, 912-1404, which is the economic diversification account. And we set up an account to have money available to do what we're trying to do in this particular bill. They will be paid per diem and mileage and other expenses. That would be for the executive council, no salary. And then this is where it's the same page. On page 16, we talk about the appropriations. We have Senate confirmation of the appointment of the appointed members of the Diversity Options for Wyoming Executive Council, and then we have the appropriation there for $2.5 million. And with that, Madam Chairman, I'd like to go to the Standing Committee Amendment and explain that, and if it's okay, we can take a vote on that. And, Madam Chairman, what the Standing Committee Amendment does, on page 1 of line 11 in the title, we talk about specifying use of the funds. And if you look at your Standing Committee Member number 1 to Senate File 132, that deals with line 2, page 1, line 11, and then the guts of that, it starts on line 14, which is page 16, which we felt we should have a little more direction in the $2.5 million, and you can read what it says there. But of that appropriation, $1.5 million shall be earmarked for expenditure under this act for workforce development recommended by the Endow Executive Council to carry into effect the state's economic diversification strategy. And we think that this is very important because these funds should be earmarked to deal with possibly training, and some of those diversification opportunities that exist. And that's what the purpose of that part of the amendment is, Madam Chairman. The other part of the amendment is on page 11 as well, and it's more or less a cleanup amendment. If you look at page 11, line 3, where it says, line 3, where we put the comma, and then down on line 4, we talk about the directors are determined by the governor and Endow Executive Council. That's a cleanup. The Madam Chairman, further on that line, starting on that page, starting on line 10, after zones, we eliminate the rest of that particular section. It's redundant, and we already talked about it in the first part of it. With that, Madam Chairman, I'd be glad to answer any questions on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Discussion on the amendment. Senator Case?
Madam Chairman, I know that the President wouldn't mind. May I have privilege of the floor?
Yes. Senator Case.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And Mr. President, 25 years ago when we were over in the House, a great mentor for us was Madam Clarine Law, who's here visiting us today. And she's been my partner for 20-plus years and my good friend ever since those days. And Ogden, I know that you support me in welcoming this great lady of Wyoming. She's accompanied by Dan Wigner, who drove her down here. So Clarine Law, everybody, hooray. Privilege of the floor for a House member? Absolutely. Well, you know, this is really special for me because 22 years ago, Madam Chairman was an intern for Senator Larson, and I kind of pigtailed on him a glory rider. Somebody very, very dear to me. Madam Chairman, this gives me great pleasure to see you in this capacity. And gives me a lot of pleasure to see all of you, and thank you for your service. But in particular, Mr. President, my Mr. Speaker, thank you so much. You guys, it's just wonderful to see all of you, and if I had a word to say, I'd say respect the process, respect each other, don't fool with tourism. Let's see what else do I want to say. Thanks so much.
We're here.
Come to our reception.
Yeah, come to our reception.
I plan on it.
And thank you very much.
Senator Bebout.
May I have privilege of the floor?
Yes, Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I would just tell members of the Senate that you just heard from one of the real icons of the great state of Wyoming, Clarine Law. Nobody loves or works harder or cares more about this great state than she does and her family, and they've done so many wonderful things. So just giving of their time and everything else. She's just a special lady, and I will tell you that when I was down the hall when they were listening to what we did, and more than they maybe do now, but that was supposed to be funny, everybody. But she was the chairman of travel, and she did an outstanding job. So, Madam Chairman, as I call her, thank you so much for your service to Wyoming and for what you do. You're an incredible lady.
Thank you, Clarine Law, for everything. And I just can't even begin to tell you how much it means to me to see you here today. Thank you. Let's talk about that amendment. Representative Anselmi Dalton.
Chairwoman, I wanted to thank Clarine Law. She's in the hospitality business with her, and I've always admired her. But I also wanted to welcome Sandy Newsom, who is our past chairman of our tourism board, and she'll be at the reception tonight and urges everyone also to attend with Clarine Law tonight. And so if we could welcome Sandy Newsom, Cody, Wyoming.
Alrighty, let's get back to work. Senator Anderson.
Yes, on the proposed amendment here, I see it isn't finalized yet. I question whether we should pull off $1.5 million for workforce development. I'd be an advocate of doing that, but I thought we were going to put these 15 people to work to decide what our 20-year plan was, and I think we're preempting some of their work by pulling the money off. Maybe all the $2.5 million ought to go to workforce development. I don't know. But it seems to me like we're preempting their work.
Further discussion on the amendment, Senator Bebout? Or, I'm sorry, Senator Hicks.
Madam Chairman, and kind of along those same lines, and so the question that comes to my mind is with the $1.5 million appropriation, is something going to happen so quick regarding workforce development? And I have less concerns about that as I do the second provision in here that says these earmarked funds may be expended by the governor for other purposes consistent with the provisions of this act. Should the governor determine if the immediate economic diversification opportunity exists? So the question is obviously, there was a lot of discussion along this and not having the luxury of sitting through the testimony of that. What kind of economic opportunities would happen so fast between the 10-month period that we're here from 1 year to the next year that we couldn't come back and appropriate some money for that. And the way this is wrote, I believe those funds stay there for until we would actually do revert those funds through a separate piece of legislation. I'm just worried about putting $1.5 million in an account for some future purpose yet that is undefined, that we can't act quickly and nimbly enough between the session to fully fund that if it's needed. Just some discussion on that.
Further discussion on the amendment? President Bebout?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'll try to answer those questions. First of all, the total appropriation is $2.5 million, and it is one-time money. So what this amendment does is it just says of that $2.5 million that we recognize the importance of the workforce development. We say that you shall consider, you know, spending $1.5 million of that. And as to whether or not we'll need it immediately, I can't answer that question. You know, it could be that that money sits there, and it might be that it sits there until next year. However, one of the things we're really looking at are those innovative zones, which are huge projects. And you look at the size of those, they're billion-dollar-plus projects. It could be in the there's projects like that of that magnitude in the soda ash business. There's certainly projects of that magnitude in the petrochemical industry. And if you look at the access to our neighbors to the north, a lot of it, like I said earlier, was workforce development. But it gives the flexibility to this council of 15 to make that decision with the governor's oversight. You know, ladies and gentlemen, it's really simple. You know, if we're going to allow the executive branch to move forward and try to do the diversification of a component of this, you know, we can't get in there and tell the executive branch what to do specifically, but we sure can put some guidelines and tell them where we think the money should be funded as we are the appropriators. And I would ask you that to consider and pass this amendment. If there's some better language or you feel like we should give them latitude for all of it, you know, that's certainly something we could talk about. But we felt this was a good compromise. Let's understand. And when you talk to these businesses that want to relocate here, they understand the tax climate that we have here. They understand other issues that make it, you know, determine whether or not they move here, like our markets and distant from market. But one of the things they consistently bring up is what kind of workforce do you have and is there proper training to utilize the specific talent we want. And a lot of that, Madam Chairman, is things like skilled labor with a lathe and try to do things where you have that particular skill, welding, some of those things. So it's a workforce that's out there in Wyoming, but there's some specialized training that could be necessary for some of the companies we're trying to recruit to bring in. So I'd ask that you support this.
Further discussion on the amendment, Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I'd ask that the amendment be divided. I would ask that Division 1 be lines 5 through 13, and Division 2 be lines 1 through 4 and 14 through 28, so that the specification on the funds is a separate question from the amendment on page 11.
That division is in order. Senator Rothfuss, would you like to speak to Division 1?
It's a good amendment. Vote for it.
Question on Division 1 of Standing Committee Amendment 1 to Senate File 132. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Division 1 has passed. We're on to Division 2. Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I also oppose this, and I understand, certainly having been involved in a lot of these conversations, how critically important workforce development is. But I do agree with the concept that it's not as much money nearly as it should be, the $2.5 million. If we want to diversify the economy, we're going to need a lot more than that. But we don't have it right now. That said, for us to be tying the hands on the limited resources that we're providing to be recommended by the governor, by this Council of 15, on what the best path forward is, or even providing recommendations presupposing an outcome, I think is premature. I would encourage the body to reject the second division of this amendment and just leave the funds to be allocated as they're needed, recognizing that, again, there's a lot of work to be done, and this may not be the first step. It may be the first step, but it may not be the first step, and there's no reason for us to push it in that direction at this time.
Further discussion, Vice President Von Fladern.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I agree that $2.5 million probably is not enough money, but I would also say that it says these earmark funds may be expended by the governor for other purposes. So with this council and the governor, should they decide to spend all $2.5 million towards some kind of economic diversity, he has that option. He also has the option, and they shall listen to the community colleges and any other trainers as to how much money they would need, and they better have a good argument for using that money, because I really believe this council and the governor will decide whether or not any of that is spent for workforce training, or maybe all of it is, but at least has the option within the bill, and that's what counts on this. So standing for Division 2.
Further discussion on Division 2, Senator Hicks.
Madam Chairman, so the question I have is, as I read the bill, we're already appropriating on line 16, section 14. There's $2.5 million already. Does the amendment not now restrict what those expenditures can be? Is the amendment, the way I read it, actually restricts what that $2.5 million could be expended upon? And is that the real purpose of the amendment? To me, it constrains them. It still says they can do, but do we really need the amendment with the existing language in Section 4? So I'm not convinced we need the amendment on it against the amendment.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, my recollection was from our committee heard the testimony on this particular bill, was that the observation is absolutely correct. This is $1.5 million of the $2.5 million that's of this appropriation. So it's not additional money. It's of the $2.5 million. There's a designation for this $1.5 million. My recollection is also in the testimony from the governor's office with respect to this bill was that this is not something that was offered by the committee on its own, but it's something that was worked out with the committee, with the sponsor, and with the governor's office. So there's a unanimity with respect to this particular provision on the proposers. Now, obviously, we have the ability to change that or do something different with it, but this wasn't something that came in, but was actually there was consensus by, like I say, among the committee, the sponsor, as well as the governor's office.
Further discussion on Division 2. President Bebout.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. And one other thing, too, and quite frankly, you know, what we really wanted to try to accomplish here is there's a lot of situations where, because workforce training was so important to these businesses were considered Wyoming, we wanted to accent and show them that, yeah, we understand the importance of workforce training, and so we're just saying, of this amount of money, this would be a way that we would really look at it, spending it, and that's why we put the language in there. Doesn't restrict the governor from doing whatever he wants to do or spending it all on that. But it's a good bill, Madam Chairman. This amendment, I thought, tightened it up a little bit from our perspective, but quite frankly, if it should fail, you know, we were able to do it, but I still think it's the right thing to do and ask you to support it.
Further discussion on Division 2? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Von Flader's motion to adopt Division 2 of Standing Committee Number 1 to Senate File 132, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The division passes. We are on the bill. Senator Scott?
Madam Chairman, two related concerns, and let me raise both of them. First, on page 2, line 5, I see there, develop a 20-year comprehensive and coordinated economic diversification plan. Madam Chairman, and maybe I've been jaded by my experience with a certain large agency that I deal with quite a bit, but you put the words comprehensive and coordinated in the statute, and you're asking for massive bureaucratic meetings without end, and they may or may not get anything done when they get through a meeting. I'm just a little concerned about what we're getting into here, and maybe it's unavoidable, and maybe it's really a function of the management to deal with that. Second question is more fundamental, Madam Chairman. why are we creating, it looks to me like we're creating a new agency. We have a business council that's charged with doing many of these things. Why do we need to create a new agency as opposed to simply taking the appropriation, giving it the business council, and modifying their statutes to sharpen their focus a little bit? And that's where I'm, Madam Chairman, that's where I'm struggling with this bill. What does it add to what we already have with the business council?
Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And my questions are along the same lines. I'm wondering what the differences are in the, you know, the descriptions of the members of the business council as far as appointees. And if that's, if there are no differences, maybe we just revisit what the, I guess, the constraints or the guidance that we have in those appointees. I certainly would not have any problems putting the chairman of the House and Senate Minerals and Business Economic Development Committees on the Business Council as ex officio members, and expanding that, and not putting any appropriation out. I guess I'm looking at, I know we want to diversify, but I'm just wondering whether or not the time this thing gets up and running and everything is appointed, that if we just couldn't add the House and Senate chairman to the business council as ex officio, whether or not that would get us off and going a lot faster than trying to reinvent the wheel, so to speak. I don't know what size of wheel this is compared to the business council, whether it's a smaller wheel or a bigger wheel or a wheel headed in a different direction. But, you know, I'm just kind of curious as to if we would line up the guidance for the business council appointees versus the guidance that we have in here, whether or not we could just pull in and change the guidance a little bit in the business council and add our two legislative friends on that, whether we'd end up with something that was a little more nimble as far as getting started faster.
Senator Anderson?
Madam Chairman, I share the same concerns as the senator from Bates Creek. We asked for a 20-year program here, and then we say the governor can expend funds immediately. So I don't know if that's a 20-year plan. Also, I have a problem with 15 voting members that are appointed by the governor, and they'd be 15 strong-willed members that would be difficult to get to agree to a path, if you will. I like the idea of a couple of our guys getting on the business council and getting them directed into the right place. I also question $2.5 million at this time in our budget session that we don't have to expend right now.
Further discussion on the bill? Senator Hicks?
Chairman, I like the idea and the concept. That just the structure of it gives me some concerns. And let me see if I can go through this, because I had the privilege a couple of years ago with some of the other legislators to actually fly up to Edmonton and look at the Heartland Industrial Park. And it is a tremendous opportunity if you ever get a good chance to see how to put value added and build industry and build your communities and build your tax base. It's certainly something. But when we came back with that, it seems to me like we did appropriate some money at that point in time to look at establishing these large business parks. That's been, I think, 3 years ago. What happened to that effort? And is this a duplication of that effort? So I'm trying to figure out what happened to that appropriation for those monies and why that didn't go forward for the last couple of years. And if this is to try to re-jump some of that initiative, I understand this is a lot of broader, but I'm trying to understand what happened in the last 3 years that didn't facilitate this to happen. Is this going to address that issue?
Further discussion on the bill? President Bebout?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. All very good questions. I'll try to answer them in an order that I think are relevant. I'll start with a question about why the money now. And I've been in business most of my adult life, and some of the hardest decisions you have to make is when you're broke and don't have any money. But yet you have to look at the real world you live in. You have to figure out where you're going to spend the money. You have to make an effort to do that. And so to say simply because we have a shortage of money, not be forward seeking, and we have the money in LISRA to do this, we need to spend money now to prepare for what we're doing out in the long term. So I think that's an argument that I don't buy at all. As to the new agency and why not the business council, we've talked about this at length, and why not just use the business council. The business council was formed in 1998, I believe, and it came out of a group of people that met up in Sheridan to talk about what we can do to diversify our economy. And you know, and it's done a good job, but what it's done primarily, if you look at when we started the business council, we really had no local economic development efforts. And what the business council has done over the years, and it's been now 20-some years, you know, that they've done that, is we now have a lot of local economic development groups working and participating. And what the business council has done through the BRCs and different things, they really promoted the local side. They've been primarily involved in infrastructure and doing those kind of things to prepare the local areas for this kind of thing. But what we really haven't had is that component that talks about a real diversification plan. And to me, as a businessman, you know, it's, you know, you get up in the morning and you shave and you make your business plan for the next 10 years doesn't work. As far as the language on comprehensive coordinated, yeah, well, I didn't draft this, but I missed that one. If we want to change that, I'm certainly okay with that. You know, it's really, you know, senators, make up your own mind about this. If we try to let the business council go and do what they're doing, we haven't really focused on this like I think we should. And so you're losing an opportunity now to really try to make an effort for a longer-term plan. We tried to put sideboards in there. We tried to hold them accountable, all these different dates. Will this thing work? I don't know. All I know is nothing in the past has really got us to the point where we need to get to. The governor seems to be on board. The last thing I will mention, we all come and go. The governor's going to be gone here in a year and a half. As far as being reelected, he's not going to leave the state or anything, but you know, a lot of us will be here, a lot of us won't, but we really are relying on the private sector. And to me, that's what makes the economic diversity component work, is private sector. And my colleague from BAGS talked about the thing in Alberta, driven by private sector with the state up there, the province, supporting that with ways they could support it like we would through the business council and through the administrative side of the governor. Good questions. If someone's got a better plan and wants to do some amendments to make this stronger, I'm all for that. We've got to do something, members of the Senate. Clearly, it hasn't worked over the history of our great state. I'd hate to see it leave here and not have something that really looks at the diversification component. I would ask that you support the bill.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, on in support of the bill. A couple of other things, just if I can add on to the President, that have been talked about both in committee as we look at this bill, is this is to provide a higher level view and to coordinate. We've had a number of disjointed efforts over the years. Many of us have voted for some of those, and we voted against some of those about, and you go, I mean, the list of some of those things, I think you can find it on page two, as you go through and look at some of those things we've looked at and some of the programs we've done. And one of the problems we've had is there hasn't been a single place where those reside, a single place where those can be coordinated, and a single place to figure out how to make them work together. So we've thrown some money here, and we've thrown some money there. And so it is time, I think, to retrench and take a look at this and try and figure out how to do this and move forward in a responsible manner. So as we talk about this, we're talking about bringing in several other agencies, not creating a new agency, but bringing a group that can oversee and then provide some direction and some innovation to some of the existing agencies we have, the Wyoming Business Council, the Department of Workforce Services, potentially DEQ. You go out and look, the potential Oil and Gas Commission, to look, how do you pull this together and how do you make all these things work so that we can clear the way to have responsible but effective economic development? So as we look at the council, we're not talking about just picking some people who are already in government. We're talking about finding CEOs, are the people who may not even live in Wyoming anymore, but have some kind of tie here. They graduated from the University of Wyoming. They grew up here. Or maybe they made their fortune here and went somewhere else. But to come back, and you can, and you know who some of these folks are. It doesn't take, you know, we know who some of these folks are. And they've expressed an interest in participating, but then from an industry perspective, from that great, that overall perspective of both of the private sector to advise government about how do we do this effectively? How do we coordinate that? And that's the type of 15 members that we're talking about. Some of those be probably the Director of Workforce Services and probably the Executive Director of the Wyoming Business Council, probably. But the rest, but most of them, or a significant number of them, will be those from private sector who can lead, who can help us figure out how to do this, how to remove the regulation, how to have the right statutes in place, and to move forward this in a coordinated manner. I can tell you this is important enough that the governor has promised that if this bill is passed, he will take one of his top advisors, and he will dedicate this guy, that the other responsibilities he have will be removed, and his job is to make this happen, to oversee it. Not a new position, just one of his, they're going to make that, they're going to clear off his calendar and his desk from some of his other responsibilities, and that will be his job the remainder of this governor's term, is to get this thing going and get it organized and move it forward. So is it loose? Is it a step forward? Absolutely. Is it the right time to do it? There's probably never been a better time, as we all understand the effects and the risks that come with having the lack of diversification. We have a great diversification in minerals. Part of this is not just to diversify in non-mineral things, but to find things that add value to minerals. Diversification can come in some things we're very expert in. We've already talked about some of those. Let's move forward with the conversation. If you have your ideas, let's get them in here. If we want some direction, let's make those proposals and get them in here. If there's some restrictions or sideboards you want on this, let's make those amendments and get those in here. But let's move this thing forward as an opportunity to really finally do what we're talking about, and that's make not only business friendly, but streamline and prepare and promote Wyoming as in a more diversified and strategic way. Thank you.
Senator Dockstader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make it quick. There's been a lot said, especially from our good leadership over there. If you don't think the times have changed, come on down and join us down in L55. Sit in there for a couple hours and watch some of the gut-wrenching decisions that have to be made. It's all changed. We have to fall back on plans like this now to get an overall better plan for the state of Wyoming. We've done it in our own little way over on the west side. We brought some key business leaders together every summer. We're going to do it again this coming summer in the fall and bring the leadership of the state over to talk to us about it, where they sit around, not too fancy of a situation, sit around a campfire and say, what can we do to diversify? And they're looking at the west side. Well, this puts a template. This puts the sideboards on it. This allows us to step out and do take care of our own salvation, if you will, and lift ourselves up by our own bootstraps and figure this out, because it's not going to come off the mineral-based economy anymore. It won't. That's over. I ask for your support of this bill.
Further discussion? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Von Flederden's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 132, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Senate File 132 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for... Senator Agar?
May I have privilege of the floor for a moment?
Yes.
You know, it's a rare occasion that individuals from my corner of the state make it down here while we're in session. I just wanted to take a moment and introduce Mary Ann Rush with the Chamber of Commerce in Thermopolis, and Dan Bleak, who is with one of the local lodging operations in Thermopolis as well. Could we just give them a warm welcome, please?
Welcome. Senator Christensen.
Yes, privilege of the floor, Madam Chairman.
Yes.
I want to continue that and just welcome Wyoming's second largest industry. We're talking about industry and innovation, and here are a bunch of community leaders that are in our second largest industry and representing tourism, and they're here for the annual Governor's Hospitality and Tourism Conference. And there's a reception tonight at Little America from 6 to 8, and we're hoping you'll all be able to come out and attend. Again, this is Main Street and the backcountry. So all of Wyoming represented here with tourism. Please give them a hand.
Welcome, everybody. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 167. The reading clerk, will you please read the bill?
Senate File 167, Workers' Compensation Rate Discount Modification and Credit, an act relating to workers' compensation, sponsored by Senator Bebout, was referred to Committee Number 10, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Baldwin, Boner, Bouchard, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. Senator Scott, what is your pleasure?
Madam Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with a recommendation that Senate File 167 do pass. It was a standing committee amendment. I ask it be read in at this time.
Senate File 167, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 3, line 12.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, I yield to Senator Bebout for an explanation of both the bill and the Standing Committee Amendment.
Senator Scott, I believe President Bebout can't move it.
Oh, I can.
President Bebout.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I would move Standing Committee Member Number 1 to Senate File 167, and members of the Senate, when we get to that part of the bill, I will explain what it is, and then we'll talk about the amendment later. But I'd like to go through the bill first of all, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, as I was sitting and reflecting on this, what's going on in our great state of Wyoming and thinking about the private sector, and, you know, a lot of people in the private sector are certainly hurting in terms of their work product, the amount of slowdown that's occurred not only in the minerals industry but all parts of our state. And I one of the things that we've done such a great job of, and I believe my tall colleague from Natrona County was around, and other members of the Senate, when we had a real problem with workers' comp, had a special session to deal with it. Well, Madam Chairman, I will report to you today that special session paid great dividends to the great state of Wyoming, and not only the workers but also the employers. And today that fund is approaching $2 billion in terms of the amount of money we've set aside for workers' comp. And also, Madam Chairman, every year the revenues we receive for those that pay into workers' comp is around $250 to $280 million. And the amount of money we spend out of that account to take care of the accidents and things that happen within workers' comp, which, by the way, Madam Chairman, is the arrangement we have with the constitutional provision and third-party litigation to take care of those employees, is about a $60, $70, $80 million differential. So what I thought about, Madam Chairman, was why not give the employers of the state of Wyoming a holiday? You know, they work hard. They're going through tough times. We pay into a very, very well-funded, actuarially sound workers' comp fund. So why not give them a holiday? And that was the start of this bill, Madam Chairman, was to look at that fund. I will tell you that I've spoken with Workforce Services. We worked together throughout the entire part of this bill. And we came up with a resolution between us that, in fact, yes, the fund is very actuarially sound. And, yes, we could, in fact, give a one-month holiday. And so, Madam Chairman, with that in mind, I'd like to go through the bill. And along the way, they had several other suggestions that I will point out as well. And, Madam Chairman, if you go to page 2, excuse me, you'll see one of the first changes we made. And what we have is we called our experience modification rate, the EMR. Madam Chairman, what this does is if you're performing very well as an employer and your EMR is high, which means you have low, you have very few accidents reports, you receive benefits in your EMR, which affects your rates. We have several provisions in there that allow these employers to do certain things that only help provide safety for these employees. And one of them is a safety program, one is a drug and alcohol testing, and another one is a health and safety consultation program. Madam Chairman, those were 5, 10, and 10. And the purpose of this bill is to increase the 5% one for drug and alcohol testing to 10. And as presented to me, and I think presented to the Labor Committee, that program is really working, and the department thought we could take that from 5 to 10%. And at the end of the day, the benefits we receive by allowing those companies, those employers, to have a better EMR will be more than offset by what we do in terms of protecting the employees. That's what page 2 does, Madam Chairman, on line 8. On line 18, we have to take that from 25 to 30 just to make the math work. Then, Madam Chairman, you go to page 3, and one of the things that happened, we talked about diversification a little bit ago. We've had companies relocate to Wyoming, and I think one of them might have been out of Colorado, or several have been from Colorado, but regardless of where they come from, they moved into Wyoming with a very good EMR rating. They've been a very safe company. However, under our statutes, we have to go to a 3-year average of that, and they were, in fact, victimized, if you will, to have to pay a very high workers' comp rate relative to what they were paying because of their rating and how well they had their safety program when they moved into Wyoming. Madam Chairman, what this does, if you look at 2714207, beginning on line 10 through the bottom of the page and over to the top of page 4, this allows our workers' comp division, if a new company relocates to Wyoming, then they shall, if they feel appropriate, look at that EMR rating or that experience rating of that company and take that into consideration when they gave them the new rate that they will have for their employees in the state of Wyoming. And that's what that does, Madam Chairman. And then on that same page, I'll explain the Standing Committee Amendment. On page 3, line 12, we added the word after moves or expands. There's a situation where it might be an expansion rather than just moving, and we didn't want to preclude those people from being able to have that benefit. The last part of the bill, Madam Chairman, on page 4, is the language that talks about this one-month holiday or premium credit that we will receive. Madam Chairman, there's some sideboards on that. They have to have had a good standing with workers' comp between January 1 of this year through December 31st of this year. And to qualify, this good standing has to be there, and they will have to qualify for that. They will be given the rate holiday this year and this year only, and it would be effective August 1st of 2017 through December 1st of 2017. Madam Chairman, what that means is they have to be in good standing, be in the program for 1 year. If they qualify and they've done all that, they can apply for that credit in the last half of this year we're in now. If they don't apply, it goes away, and it's a one-time deal. With that, Madam Chairman, if there's any questions on the Standing Committee Amendment, I moved it. I'd be glad to answer them. Otherwise, ask for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Any discussion on the amendment? Question has been called. All those in favor of Senator Bebout's motion to adopt Standing Committee Number 1 to Senate File 167, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. The amendment passes. We're back on the bill.
Madam Chairman, that's the bill. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Further discussion? Minority Leader Rothfuss.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm curious about the EMRs and whether all states use the same rating system or whether there is any difference from state to state. I'm not familiar with that detail. If the President could answer that, I appreciate it.
Further discussion on the bill? Senator Scott?
With regard to that, our system is probably unique. Now, most states, I think probably all states, use some version of an experience rating system. It's one of the reforms when we did the reform starting back in 1993 was to go to an experience rated system because we had the misfortune of not being that way. It was one of the things that got us in trouble. But we're one of four states that is a monopoly state with a state-run system. So what they'll have to do, bringing in an experience rating from another state, is adapt it. And it's been a chronic problem. You bring somebody in that is long established, has a good safety program, and then you stick them with a higher rate right off. It makes it harder to recruit. So this part of it, I would submit, Madam Chairman, is somewhat experimental. I think it'll work. I think it'll be helpful as we go out and try to recruit new businesses. But it will require our workers' comp program to adapt to circumstances coming in from the other states and figure out what the rating in the other state means.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chairman, thank you very much. I applaud our good senator for bringing this bill. You know, as a small businessman, I've been certainly paying into the fund since 1982, and we've never had a claim, and knock on wood is right.
Just jinxed it.
And so, you know, for those of us who have who have paid into the system a lot. Thank you. But one thing I did want to, since it is going to be a premium credit for the last quarter, basically, I believe, or third quarter, will there be enough notice to those employees, because it's a one-time, it goes away thing, will there be, I'm hoping that there will be a good campaign by the state to notify employers that there is a premium credit out there, and that they so that they don't miss it.
Further discussion on the bill? President Bebout.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. That's a great point, and I don't think we should probably put it in the bill, but we certainly should make sure that that word gets out. And the other thing, Madam Chairman, just to let you know, we couldn't put in there exactly what that percentage would be and how it would affect it. That's why we have the language we have on page 4, section 2. But I will submit to you, Madam Chairman, and I think members of the Labor Committee probably heard the testimony, that the amount of money we're talking about is in the $15 to $20 million range, which is about an 8% reduction for that period of time. That's the significance of it. It's huge, but it's certainly something we ought to do.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you. Just a question for those on the Health Committee, if they know the answer to this, is Madam Chairman, is there still a fund building premium built into the Workers' Compensation Division? I mean, there's the experience rate and the other things, and I think in the past there's been a fund building premium. I'm just wondering if that's in effect, or is it kind of like, it's kind of like sagegrass protection. We still hunt them even though that we're trying to save them. So anyway, I just wonder.
Wait a minute. We're not talking about
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, the sage-grouse issue is an entirely different issue. Madam Chairman, there was, because when we started out and the reform started in 1993, workers' comp was flat broke, was using this month's premium to pay last month's bills, and was in debt to the general fund. And now we're at the point where we can rationally consider this sort of thing. There was a catch-up period. It was quite painful because it came in part during a downturn. And it, Madam Chairman, has been allowed, I don't remember how many years ago, to expire because we'd gotten the job done. It may still be on the books in case we ever need it again, but that's not likely. And the most recent figures I've seen were that workers' comp is either over-reserved or exactly reserved, depending on whether or not you make allowance for the earnings that the reserve fund makes. So we have come a long way. It's been a very successful reform, and taking advantage of it in a time when we have an economic downturn and our employers are hurting, Madam Chairman, it frankly makes a lot of sense to me.
Further discussion? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 167, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Senate File 167 has passed Committee of the Whole. Senator Baldwin.
Privilege of the floor, please, madam.
Yes, please.
If everybody could direct their looks to the back here and make sure all these kids are smiling, I'd like to direct your attention to some kids with their fearless teacher who have traveled here across windy Wyoming roads with their fearless teacher from Pinedale High School. If you could all give them a big welcome to the Senate.
Welcome to Cheyenne. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 151. The reading clerk will read the Senate file.
Senate File 151, Ignition Interlock, an act relating to motor vehicle licenses, sponsored by Senator Kinski.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable consideration on Senate File 151, ignition interlock to present this bill will be the fine Senator Kinski.
Senator Kinski.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. There is an amendment to Senate File Fund 50 Fund, and I'd ask if it could be read in.
Will the reading clerk please read it in?
Senate File 151, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 4, line 9.
I would move for approval of the amendment. Very briefly, on page 4, it inserts the word restricted into three places to make the nomenclature consistent throughout the bill. And if we could just dispose of that amendment, then I'll proceed to walk through the bill as a whole, Madam Chairwoman.
Discussion on the amendment?
Question.
Questions being called. All those in favor of Senator Kinski's motion to adopt Standing Committee Number 1 to Senate File 151, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment passes. Senator Kinski?
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. This bill relates to dealing with impaired driving in the state of Wyoming. It was originated with the governor's task force on impaired driving. They found some gaps in the law that needed to be remedied, so to that extent, it's a fix-it bill. And they also, in the course of their deliberations, found that another new DUI prevention program that the state has adopted, that is the 24/7 sobriety program, needs to be more fully integrated with the ignition interlock program. So with that, let me take a brief walk through the bill. The current law requires that, at least since 2011, any repeat DUI offender must serve a period of time with an ignition interlock system. And first-time offenders must have an ignition interlock if their BAC was greater than 0.15. The issue is a large number of those who are required to use the ignition interlock do not. They either sit it out or flout the law, and part of what we're doing here is intended to remedy that. The data from other states shows that where offenders do successfully complete the ignition interlock plan, it affects double-digit reductions in recidivism. So we are literally talking about saving lives by helping these programs to be more effective. So with that, on the on page 2 of the bill, you will see that on lines 7 and 8, we've added a sentence about deferral of prosecution. And that's because approximately 25% of the DUI offenses do not necessarily result directly in a conviction, but in a deferral. And we've had some prosecutors and judges getting a little bit high-centered on, you know, can we put them on the ignition interlock if it's a deferral and they haven't had a conviction? So this makes clear, both here and in lines 11 and 12, that a deferred prosecution is part of the interlock program every bit as much as an actual conviction. On page 3, lines 10 through 11 and lines 21 through 22, you will see that language referencing a 45-day suspension period has been eliminated. And that's simply because, while originally it thought there should be a minimum 45-day suspension period, coordinating that with the court calendar ended up with some folks going way longer than the law provides and feeling like they were being double penalized. And there's a desire by some in law enforcement not necessarily to wait that long, but to get on with it. Let's keep these people at work, keep them paying taxes, but get them sober with this, the help of this ignition interlock device. On page 4, you'll see where an entire section 6 through 14, this specifies that somebody cannot get their license until they have actually served the period of time required to have the ignition interlock. It's a loophole in the law where some people could just say, I just won't get the ignition interlock, and I'll just wait until my time is up, and then I'll go get myself a clean driver's license without a license restriction. And that's a problem because the ignition interlock has been shown to be effective. So this helps with the mandatory nature of the ignition interlock program. Then lines 16 through 20 simply provides that if they begin the ignition interlock program before their conviction is entered, which is something we want to do, get them on the program as quickly as possible, that pre-conviction time will apply towards the mandatory amount of time they're supposed to have the ignition interlock system. At the bottom of page 4, lines 22 through 23, and on to the top of page 5, lines 1 through 4, this language provides that for those who are enrolled in 24/7, time in that program can serve in lieu of the ignition interlock program. Now, 24/7 is a program that is currently being implemented in 4 high-priority counties in Wyoming, and it has been shown to be even more effective in stopping recidivism for DUI than has the ignition interlock. The combination of the two programs in tandem, we hope, will have a significant impact on DUI offenses in Wyoming. I would add here parenthetically that on second reading, assuming there is a second reading, I have an amendment that was prepared over the weekend by the Attorney General's office with some additional language regarding service and the 24/7 in lieu of the ignition interlock program. It's important also that both options be available. There are some folks that just, you know, may want to just say, just give me the ignition interlock. The 24/7 requires testing twice daily. For those not familiar with it, it says if you have this offense, you go blow a breathalyzer or get a UA once in the morning and once in the evening, and you do it for X number of months while you're going through your treatment. And there may be some people that just say, look, just take the ignition interlock device. I can't get to town twice a day. And so that'll give us greater flexibility. And the amendments tomorrow, I think, will help clarify exactly how the 24/7 and the ignition interlock programs work together. On page 5, this is lines 8 through 12. And this is intended to deal with what has come to be seen by some judges or some prosecutors as a loophole. The original language now says no person licensed under this article shall drive any vehicle without a functioning and certified ignition interlock device. That is, if they have a restricted license, which they're supposed to apply for. But it does not say if you're required to have one and you keep driving anyway, you're in trouble for that. So we've added the language, no person required to apply for an interlock restricted license or whose driving privilege has been restricted to operating vehicles with an interlock device by a court or an agency shall drive any motor vehicle. And then again, the same language repeated in lines 15 through 19. And my fellow members of the Senate, is the update to the ignition interlock legislation. I'd stand for questions.
Thank you, Senator Kinski. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. You know, this is a great handout. I really like the way that it was put together. But there's some assumptions here that I want to kind of question. In one, on page one, it says the obvious concern is that high-risk offenders are not installing the ignition interlock devices as they are required by law, are continuing to drive with a suspended license. Well, folks, I'm not really sure if we need this bill now that we have felony eluding. But that being said, Madam Chairman, really, what if these folks have spent so much on their attorney fees to get a deferment that they had to sell their car and they can't drive anyway? Okay, what are we going to do there? Are we going to require them to buy a car and put an ignition interlock device in here because it's mandatory? I'm just curious. It seems like we are going to do that because it is mandatory now that you do this. And if they don't have it, or we say, yeah, you buy it, you pay the fees to the person for the ignition interlock and all of the monthly fees that go along with it for the monitoring and everything else, And so, yeah, we're gonna make sure you have an ignition interlock device sitting in your back porch. Yeah, that's really effective, Madam Chairman. I think that presumption that all these people are driving with a suspended license, and if they are, then what are law enforcement officers doing here when you have two-thirds of the 2026 and two-thirds of the 2035 and 70% of the 2016 out there driving a suspended license? I mean, I would think that our county jails would be full with that six-month sentence that we have right now. I'm really curious on that. And then especially if you look at it in light of some of the things that's going to happen, I think, in this legislative process, is that we're going to have an opportunity to get your cell phone and call a ride. And so, you know, I think that people necessarily wouldn't even need a car in some of the major metropolitan areas because there's going to be an option available to them. And they'll probably take that option because that's more or less could be cheaper than ignition interlock. Certainly cheaper than that if you add on a car payment and you add on everything else that goes with it. It might be that's the thing. What's wrong with serving your time? Really, you don't have a car to drive? And that's a pretty big imposition to a lot of folks. And so, you know, you basically do your time without having a car, and then you get to get back into driving a car after you've served your time not having one. That's a pretty big penalty in and among itself. So, Madam Chairman, I'm not sure there's parts of this that I think this bill has some merit. I'm not sure about the deferred prosecution part here because that's probably one of the reasons why people do get deferred prosecutions. Is so that they don't, if they're first-time offenders, and they're not repeat offenders, and they get an opportunity to go about their lives, and they get slapped pretty heavy because they're going to spend probably $3,000 to $5,000, maybe more, on attorney fees just to get through that deferred comp, to get that deferral. So that's a pretty big chunk right there. That's a pretty huge cost for people. That'll wake them up. And they'll know if they do it again, then, you know, you've had your one bite of the apple, and you're going to have some serious consequences. So I'm not sure what the recidivism rate is on deferred prosecutions, but I would think it's probably pretty low, Madam Chairman. I would think it's probably pretty low because people get a wake-up call in that situation. And I think that's why you have deferred prosecutions. So these people get a wake-up call, but it doesn't ruin their lives. So, Madam Chairman, I got some serious reservations in this. I think there's some assumptions made that necessarily don't really really mesh up with what real-life circumstances are. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Anselmi Dalton.
Chairwoman Mills, I would like to address the concerns of my colleague in the back. He is correct. Under Section G, we do provide, or the bill does provide, for those that do the 24/7 to serve as a substitute for the interlock, but he is right. This is a bill that's pretty hardcore. It's either you get that ignition interlock or you do the 24/7 and be breathalyzed according to the court's directions, which is tricky for some people. This was a concern that we had in the committee and discussed it, and we discussed also that a lot of these people are indigent and cannot afford these interlock devices, and we question the mandatory nature as well. So this is a concern. My view would be voted up or voted down.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I like the bill, and I like the way the senator from Tongue River presented it. The interlock thing needs some meat put behind it. A lady that had one of these interlocks on her car ran into me with another car that she'd bought, and so she could drive it. And so something needs to be done so they can't drive any car, not just the one with the interlock on it. My question would be, maybe somebody on the committee heard this, does a person the violator have to buy that interlock? I was told they did, and then I was told there are counties or agencies that give it to them. And the objection that I heard from her group was that they have to buy them, and they're very expensive.
Mr. Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My question goes to the specific costs. I understand that it's typically private corporations that provide this service. The service is a mandatory subscriber service. While you have the interlock, you have to go get it checked and verified, and everything you do ends up leading to a fee that is, from my understanding, commonly the reason why nobody wants to engage in the interlock program, not so much because they are trying to circumvent always, but a lot of the time because they just don't want to pay that much money to participate in the program. So I'd like to know the specific costs for an entire program, if that's available, if not today, perhaps in second reading. And I'm curious about the same thing for the 24/7 sobriety program. What would the associated costs of the total number of tests be throughout the course of the program? I understand that there is an indigent option where you can apply and have a half price basically for the program, but even that half price might still be cost prohibitive. So if we can get those numbers either today or on second reading, I would appreciate it.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. You know, on a couple of these issues, I'll just tell you that in the Judiciary Committee we wrestled with this, and the idea of why can't you just do your time and walk away from it, much like a prison sentence or a jail sentence. And really what it came back to is to make sure that we understand the difference. Freedom is a right, but driving is a privilege. And when you take that privilege on, you have some responsibility, both for your own actions, but also to make sure you don't endanger other innocent bystanders, friends, family, whatever it is. So we went back and forth, and I appreciate this in-depth discussion we're having, because these are some of the very issues we worked through. Addressing the senator's question that spoke just a moment ago, if you qualify for the SNAP program, then there is a cut in the price of the program. As far as it being too expensive, you know, it is expensive to get a DUI. I think it runs anywhere from $6,000 to $10,000, they say, by the time you're out the other side of it. And I don't know if it's our job to try to defray those costs and make it a little less painful when there's a lot of issues besides the interlock program or the 24/7 program that go into coming out the other side of a DUI.
Further discussion on the bill? Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'll just wait in a little bit. Years ago, I was the prime sponsor of the initial bill that was passed that brought in the ignition interlock. And just to shed a little bit of context and light on the bill and the work that's been done, I can tell you our interlock as it is right now is, and even with this bill goes in, it's not as onerous as a lot of states. A lot of states, not only do they do this, first of all, most states that have interdiction interlock, it's not a mandatory 6 months on the first offense, it's a mandatory year on the first offense. Another thing other states do that's not as onerous as what we do is they will print your face in the newspaper along and in wherever you live. They will print those up, and they're really nice. You get your mug shot and everything. So not only that, they go out there the way to humiliate you and make sure everybody understands what you've done. But the other side of that is that what we have is we've got to continue to change the concept that it's okay to drink and drive. As we brought this bill, I remember looking back, following a newspaper article about a Wyoming resident that had been in prison for felony DUIs, was out of prison, was on parole, sitting at a bar stool, having a drink. So she's in violation of her parole. She knows that if she goes out again that she's got issues. She gets in her car, drives down, I think, Highway 59, and runs into a nice retired couple and kills them. She's then sentenced to, so sitting on that bar, so now she's in violation of parole. She knows if she goes out, she has been drinking and runs into somebody. We had this discussion the other day. That's aggravated vehicular homicide. That's a 20-year sentence. The concept is, folks, people don't make good decisions sitting on bar stools. And so it comes down to the point, you've got to change the behavior. And if people will not do the behavior voluntarily, then you have to force the change of behavior. And that's the idea behind the ignition airlock. The benefit is that you can drive on a restricted license as opposed to having your license suspended. It's not a question of whether you get to drive or don't get to drive. If you're convicted of a DUI, you will be driving on a suspended license. I believe it's at least for 90 days. Or maybe it's 6 months. I don't remember the time. But you're going to be on a suspended license. The point of the ignition interlock is so you can continue to drive legally or even more legally, as we may have heard recently. So you can drive legally. You can continue to work. You continue to transport your kids. You continue to do those things legally with the driver's license if you have an ignition or lock device in your car. So the point isn't to beat you down so you can't work and it's more expensive. The point is to get you to behave responsibly by driving a car with an ignition or lock to make sure you're driving while you're unimpaired, while you're not impaired. The other thing is, if you go back and look at the bill, there are exemptions for driving an employer's vehicle. So if you're driving an employer's vehicle, so you're driving your boss's car, you're driving the pickup truck or the truck for your work, you don't have to have an ignition air lock in those vehicles. So those there are exceptions for your employer and work and employer-owned vehicles, provided that you're not using those employer-owned vehicles as you would a personal vehicle. So keep this in perspective. One, we're not as onerous as other states are right now. That two, the point is to allow you to continue to drive even though you would otherwise have a suspended license with a restricted license. And so if you don't like the deferred prosecution, the 301 status, you know, bring an amendment to pull that back. If you know, we can have that debate. But ultimately, there's some what we have, and you see that down. I invite anyone to go down, and we used to call them cattle calls. You go down at 1, I think they're about 1:15 in Shoshone County or 1:30, and you had all the people that prayed in front of you for all the violations and all the criminal stuff that's happened. Particularly the best days ago is Monday, because then it's all the people who come there after the weekend. And they come in and their charges are read and presented and they plead guilty or not guilty, and it's the beginning of that criminal process. I can tell you, anybody who's been down there and watched those, probably 99% of those have some kind of alcohol involvement. You don't get into a fight just to get into a fight, usually unless you're under the influence of either drugs or alcohol. You don't drive, you get picked up with a DUI, obviously you're under the influence. You don't end up having a knockdown dragout with your spouse or your girlfriend, usually unless there's drugs or other things involved, you're under the influence. So you come down and look at this, folks. It's not because people just don't make good decisions under the influence. This bill gives them a chance to remediate and show that proper behavior and move forward. It closes a number of loopholes that have been out there that's made this ineffective in Wyoming, much less ineffective than it is in other states. And I'd ask you to consider and to support the bill.
Further discussion? Senator Kinski.
Madam Chairwoman, thank you. I simply reinforce what my friend from the Natrona County said. You can defeat the bill. You will not change the already existing mandatory nature of the interlock ignition device under current Wyoming law. What you would do is perpetuate some loopholes that allow people to escape the kind of sobriety that they need. I would add, these programs, people don't just serve an ignition interlock. They're required also to seek counseling. And the ignition interlock is to try and make sure they keep their jobs and that they're staying sober. Is it a perfect program? No, it's not. We've all heard the stories of the person that's on the ignition interlock, but they have a second vehicle that they drive without it. Or we've all heard the stories about the guy that's on the ignition interlock pays somebody who's sober to blow into the interlock so that they can drive. But the fact of the matter is, when it is used and used properly, it reduces recidivism by double digits. And that's important, because that, in conjunction with 24/7, is the first real hope that we've seen in making progress against drunk driving in decades. You know, when I first became mayor and my chiefs would start talking to me about ankle braceleting and 24/7 and ignition interlocks, and I thought, you know, nothing ever seems to change on the DUI front. We've gone through it in America where it's mandatory minimums and lock them up, and what you do is drive them further into the alcohol cycle. This is based on evidence that shows if you keep them working, paying taxes, you got a better shot at making productive citizens out of them. 70% of them are not being installed. That is correct. That's a fact, and we need to keep working on it. It's not a perfect solution, but the answer to solving the drunk driving problem is you just keep working on every single tool available to you. What if they do not have a car was another question that was asked. If they do not have a car, they do not have a car. But when they decide they're going to start driving again, they must either take the 24/7 program or use the ignition interlock device successfully to obtain a new license. That's what the law provides and what this bill clarifies. I will get the information that I can on the costs of this program. I understood that question to be the entire cost for a run of offense for both the ignition interlock and 24/7. There is an indigency program to help with the cost. I'm also told by prosecutors that somebody who's really down on their luck, that the judge can back off on the fine to help out with the cost on it. So I will get those costs for you. On and for the bill. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Are you ready for the question? Question has been called. All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 151, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Senate File 151 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 89. Can we have the bill read, please?
Senate File 89, Presumptive Disability for Firefighters, an act relating to public health and safety, sponsored by Senator Landon. It was referred to Committee Number 10, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Baldwin, Boner, Bouchard, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Madam Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 89 do pass. It was a standing committee amendment. I ask it be read in at this time.
Will the reading clerk read the amendment?
Senate File 89, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, that substitute.
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, I move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. Madam Chairman, what the Standing Committee Amendment does is replace the original Senate file with a substitute bill. This was done primarily because the bill as it came to us had some defects in it. It cited the Health Department repeatedly where it should have cited Workforce Services. That was corrected. And the sponsor felt it would be less confusing, and the committee agreed if we did a substitute bill. There were a couple of substantive changes made. On page 3, we tightened the bill up. One of the requirements was you had to be employed as a firefighter for 5 years, and we changed that to 10 years, so it's enough time for the exposure to take effect. On page 6 and following, the original bill had a limitation. If you used a certain amount of tobacco, you couldn't qualify for this presumption. The committee tightened that up significantly. And that's an important feature, Madam Chairman, because for all the listed diseases here, my understanding of science is that tobacco is a major, major risk factor. So that undoes the presumption. I think my understanding of the science is that tobacco use is a risk factor for virtually all the diseases that mankind is subject to. So we did those changes, but it would be a lot simpler, Madam Chairman, if we all work off the substitute bill. So I urge its adoption.
Question has been called. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 89, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment passes. Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, I yield to Senator Landon for an explanation of this good little Senate file.
Senator Landon.
Madam Chairman, thank you very much. And I do appreciate the chairman handling the standing committee amendment and working off of the substitute bill. I think will be a good idea, and I'll walk you through that in just a moment. Senate File 89, Senators, comes to you because of a real-life story back home. Jeff was 42 years old, and when he went to the doctor told him that he had testicular cancer. Doctor said, that's extremely rare. I can't imagine a guy of your age. I don't understand it. He says, what do you do for a living? Jeff said, I am a firefighter. And the doctor said, nothing more needs to be said. I understand now why you have testicular cancer. The following few months in his family's life included bake sales and garage sales by his brethren and sisters because his benefits were denied. The assumption at that time by the state was that his cancer was not caused by his service in firefighting. Well, he was in the fight for his life, and regarding those benefits, his family, unfortunately, Madam Chairman, had to try to find an attorney, had to hire an attorney to battle for his benefits, which did not come in, unfortunately, until after his death, which ironically came on September 11th, 2 years ago. When I learned of this story, that's when I agreed to tackle this issue. And, Madam Chairman, I would imagine there are some senators here who, like me, don't really know much about presumptive disability. The tall senator from Natrona County does. It has been talked about years and years ago in Wyoming. But I want to tell you a little bit about presumptive disability by walking you through the bill. This bill, Senate File 89, creates less of a burden on families like Jeff's for proof with regard to what caused cancer. It's a benefit of the doubt, for lack of any other term. If you go to the bottom of page one, under the workers' comp statutes, we're going to create a brand new chapter, 15, presumptive disability for certain diseases. I'll walk you through the bill on page two, Madam Chairman. You'll see where we define firefighter. This bill will cover our paid firefighters. It would also cover our volunteers out across the state. And we also, through the work last week, pulled lines 11 through 15 into the bill. That's some of our private firefighters. We describe and define listed disease. You'll find that paragraph on the bottom of page 2 and up on the top of page 3. On paragraph D, that allows someone to argue the case for inclusion into this act. Paragraph E leaves room for future action by this Senate should we ever decide to cover individuals with some other disease coverage. At the bottom of page 3, we get into what was referenced by the chairman, the new language that we pulled in that says if you are a firefighter, you have to have served 10 years to qualify for this benefit. For our volunteer firefighters, bottom of page 3 and the top of page 4, we describe exactly what we expect out of volunteers if they are to qualify under Chapter 15. Lines 6 through 8, by the way, Senators, volunteer firefighter department shall keep individual records that document the criteria in this bill. That is something that they already do, so this is not an onerous request. What we were trying to do is avoid all of these volunteer departments having to send those reports down to Cheyenne.
That's not necessary. If there's a claim under Chapter 15, each of these volunteer departments out across our state already keep this kind of record. At the bottom of page 4, a firefighter who suffers from a listed disease is presumed to have developed that listed disease during the course and scope of employment, unless the contrary is proven. And that is an important clause at the end of that paragraph, fellow senators. That's where we begin to pull in the state's right to question any claim, and we'll get to that later in the bill. At the top of page 5, what presumptive disability applies to, subparagraph I, I and subparagraph double I, those are two areas where they already qualify for some benefits, Madam Chairman. That's the retirement and workers' comp. We also reference University of Wyoming and Wyoming Community College tuition and fees payments. Those are tuition and fees. That's a survivorship benefit that we do provide for EMTs, peace officers, and firefighters. It may not come into play in this bill, Madam Chairman, but we pull that in there anyway. On over on page 6, I want to call your attention to paragraph D on line 14. That is where we put in the qualifier, the disqualifier to presumptive disability, and as you can see, we list some language that was changed in committee and I think made the bill better. If you're a smoker, you're not going to qualify for if you're a smoker or a user, you're not going to qualify for any presumptive disability. Line 6 on page 7, Madam Chairman, if a case is in court for some other reason than presumptive disability, you cannot add this to the docket. This act does not create a cause of action. In other words, only under the laws and procedures that already exist can you bring something. Paragraph F, I think, is important. This act does not enlarge or establish a right to any benefit or compensation or eligibility for any benefit or compensation. A firefighter who qualifies for a presumption under this act is entitled only to the benefits or compensation that he would have otherwise been entitled to receive. Over on the top of page 8, this is where a firefighter, if a case is denied, a firefighter has the opportunity to argue on a case-by-case demonstration before the medical commission that he did indeed contract cancer through his service. Paragraph J refers back to that tobacco reference. And then at the bottom, I think, is one of the most important provisions in the bill. Fellow senators, this is the state's right for rebuttal and by showing a clear and convincing evidence that the risk factor, accident or hazard or other cause not associated with the firefighter's service. In the middle of page 9, 2714-616, that is existing language. There is a medical a hearing panel in our workers' compensation area, and what we do is add the language at the bottom, or on page 10, rather, senators, the need for rules and regs under this particular bill. That's a very quick rundown, Madam Chairman, on Senate File 89. I would only say that there are a lot of other things that we could talk about today. I've provided you with a couple of handouts that I think will be helpful in understanding presumptive cancer legislation a little bit better. One of those handouts, Madam Chairman, gives you an indication of across the country how many states have dealt with this issue. There are numerous states that have already recognized this issue. Bottom line, senators, firefighters are anywhere from 6 to 10 to 100% more likely to end up with cancer. All this does is recognize that fact. It lowers the hurdle just a little bit at a time when these families, I think, really deserve that consideration from us. Is it going to drive any cost? Yes, it will. It's very possible that a claim would drive some cost across the system
that is paid into the workers' comp fund that we talked about a little bit earlier this afternoon. The workers' comp fund is absolutely capable of supporting this benefit. I'd be glad to answer any questions, Madam Chairman. That's a really quick rundown of Senate File 89. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Landon. Mr. Minority, floor leader.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is a great piece of legislation. I appreciate the sponsor bringing it. I do have a couple of questions on how things would work, and one of those is with regard to timeline. And when this applies, this presumptive eligibility, so it seems pretty clear that it applies while the firefighter is actively employed as a firefighter. That's clear to me from the legislation, Madam Chairman. But what I don't understand is, would it apply later afterwards? I can imagine a circumstance where they've been on the job for 20 years and they quit and they're diagnosed 3 days later, something along those lines. I can imagine another circumstance where they've been on the job for 50 years, but they develop cardiovascular disease at the age of 96. Well, it seems like that's a reasonable outcome for anybody in their various employment. So I'm curious how that timeline works is one question. The second question I have, Madam Chairman, is I understand that the original draft had a 5-year period of time for employment. The Labor Committee switched that to 10 years. And I'm curious what other states have done, whether there's any consistency among the states in that timeline, or whether it varies from state to state. And maybe that's in the literature, which I'm trying to dig through my desk and find, but haven't yet. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, with regard to the timeline, happens while you're employed. If you've been employed for the minimum time, you're eligible. Or if you look on page 6, starting at line 2, has been employed for not less and seeks the presumption within 10 years after cessation of employment. And that's there for exactly the reason that the good senator referenced, that eventually your risks become more like the risks that all of us have for these diseases. So that's, and Madam Chairman, this bill and any presumptive eligibility like that, but especially this bill, it represents a balance. Most of these cancers that the firefighters, or cancers and other diseases that are listed that the firefighters get are related to their work. And, Madam Chairman, that work has been gradually getting more dangerous because particularly with regard to house fires, there are more and more plastics and plastic-like things that give off all kinds of fumes when they burn. And the testimony we had in committee was that, yes, there's breathing masks and all those things, but some of them are absorbed through the skin and you try to cover up, but it isn't perfect. And some of them come through the breathing masks, and we just don't know how to prevent some of this exposure. So the firefighters are running a very clear risk, and the statistics are quite clear. They have a much higher rate of the cancer and the other diseases. Now, we will pick up a few people who would have gotten the cancer anyhow. But what we're saying with the presumptive eligibility is the risk is so great that the workplace caused it, that rather than force everybody to go through proving it, which is very difficult with the cancer, we say, okay, we'll look at the epidemiological statistics and give you a presumptive eligibility. And, Madam Chairman, that is used in other circumstances. For example, and this is a much wider than just the firefighters, but there was a former senator here who was an advanced practice nurse at the VA and treated diabetics. I got to talking with her, and she said whenever they got a type 2 diabetes and somebody that had been exposed to Agent Orange in Vietnam, that was presumptively service-related. It's a common device. And the question also was raised with regard to the other states. there isn't full consistency, but 10 years employment before we give you the presumption seems to be a reasonable standard that other states have developed. So the timelines and the fact you're giving the presumption, it's all a balancing act. You're trying to do your best to take care of the people who are really hurt in the line of work, and this seems to be the most sensible way to do it in these circumstances, Madam Chairman. I hope that answers the questions.
Further discussion on the bill, Senator Hicks.
Yeah, Madam Chairman, on the, so we get to the issue of the presumptions on page 6. It says the presumption in Section A of this section does not apply. And then we get down to A, it says, is a regular user of tobacco for 10 or more years. And then we flip over to page 7 under subsection B. It says it was a regular user of tobacco for 10 or more years and has been fewer than 10 years since the firefighter gave. How does the state then come in and prove that somebody used tobacco for 10 years or they haven't used tobacco for 10 years? I'm just curious because the burden now shifts back on the state to prove they have or haven't used, and for the duration of the use or non-use, I'm just curious how that actually works in the real world.
Further discussion, Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. One more question with regard to the timeline. I understand that a lot better now, and I appreciate the response from the tall senator from Natrona County. What about your slower-acting agency, mesothelioma from asbestos, as an example, where it can easily take 30 years for that to come into fruition? But if you're a firefighter, you can be fairly confident that was something that was related to the occupation itself. Is that something where you wouldn't necessarily need the presumption because it would probably be a likely outcome regardless, or was there any discussion about those types of very specific ailments that would be relevant to the job but would potentially develop 10 years after cessation of employment?
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, the other question I'd have is under is it the DVSM manual or the manual of there's a manual out there that is all these recognized illnesses and diseases and anyway I'm looking at in particular that is the I understand the first we've got various kinds of cancer, lymphomas, cardiovascular disease, acute myocardial heart attack or stroke, the disease, illness, health impairment or disability determined on a case by case basis under something that, and then I think, which is very similar to E, which is any other disease, illness, health, impairment, or disability as workers' compensation medical commission prescribes our rule after verifiable research determines the dominant cause of the disease, illness, impairment, or disability was employment as a firefighter. I'm wondering there, where, is there a line to be drawn with respect to mental impairment or mental diseases? You have a number of those that are recognized diseases, depression, could be PTSD, could be stress-related inabilities, could be there. So there's a number of mental disabilities, and those mental disabilities are recognized under that manual. And you see that quite often, and under the standard workers' compensation statutes, generally it has to be some kind of stress or exposure to which the general public is not ordinarily, doesn't differentiate substantially from a member that person would have as a member of the general public. I'm just wondering, how does this work as you come back in? Because that's where the big problem comes in usually, is not so much on these physical diseases, but you get a number of mental disorders, mental diseases, mental illnesses, and how they relate back. And I'm wondering, is there a governor on that at all, or how do we determine that? Because it seems to me right now, it's, if I'm reading this right, it'd be anything the medical commission decides is a occupation-related illness, which certainly I would imagine PTSD, but and other things. But you see, that's always the problem with workers' compensation, is when you open up the mental issues and the mental disabilities, that becomes usually the problem where the real problem. That's because where the real problem fiscally lies.
Further discussion on the bill, Senator Landon.
thank you, Madam Chairman. Really appreciate the good discussion on this bill. My friend from Natrona County, I think, has hit on something that that we may want to take a look at if the bill goes forward. The idea there was to restrict this bill only to cancer impairment, and only if the commission prescribes by rule do you add anything. That may not be sideboarded enough. And so I think that could very well be a catch and something that we would want to work on for a second reading amendment if the bill goes through. Regarding, how do we know if someone was a user of tobacco products? The only thing that I think that you could count on is these physicals that are required by the firefighters, and they will document use of tobacco. Caseworkers are good at this. This is what they do. But I'll find out more information and bring that back to you as well. This does not, to answer the senator from the Ivory Towers, it does not preclude a case-by-case argument on down the road in any circumstance. We sideboard this bill at the 10-year window, but it certainly doesn't preclude someone from arguing down the road that something was caused by their service. Madam Chairman, I hope that answers a couple of the questions, a couple of those. I'd be happy to get back to the body.
Senator Kinski.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Folks, I would just urge a little bit of caution here. These are heroic people performing heroic work, and so sometimes we kind of can abandon our critical senses in the rush to do what we believe to be the right thing. I would suggest for your consideration that this is appropriate as an interim topic. I direct your attention first to the fiscal note, which in the very first paragraph says a detailed actuarial analysis would be required to get specific detailed amounts. But what you do see there in the third paragraph is an initial increase in costs of $100,000 a year. The second year, an increase by more than 50% to $154,900 a year, and an increase by the third year to $212,000 a year, a doubling of the initial expense in the span of 2 years. And that would be consistent with what has been the experience of other states. As the senator from Natrona County alluded, this bill does not limit itself just to specific types of cancers, but extends it to virtually every conceivable kind of diagnosis. So, and that's been a question these other states that have adopted it. Does it apply to mental health issues? Which cancers does it apply to? It's one thing to say Agent Orange and Vietnam service is presumptive. It's another thing to say all cancers are presumptive or all medical disorders are presumptive. There is peer-reviewed evidence from a 2009 study that shows there is not a disproportionately higher risk of cancer amongst firefighters. It examined 7 studies from 1995 to 2008. There was an experience in one jurisdiction once they adopted a presumptive law where the number of claims went from 3 cases a year to 62 cases a year, which is just extraordinary. And then the experience in other jurisdictions is once the firefighters have it, then the police want it, then the ambulance workers want it, it becomes a cascading effect. But I direct your attention in particular on pages 2 and 3. The cancers are listed, then cardiovascular disease, then stroke, then a disease, illness, health impairment, or disability determined on a case-by-case basis under the normal workers' comp procedure, and then any other disease, illness, health impairment, or disability, as may be determined, as a dominant cause is an employment as a firefighter. But by the time you then flip through the burden on the state, and my good friend from Natrona County says this is the state's right to argue the case, there's really not much for the state to stand on. Essentially, what you're saying is just wave all these cases through and pay them. Let's go there to page 8. A person opposed to the award of benefits or compensation listed under Wyoming Statute 2715-102 may rebut the presumption, well, that sounds pretty good, under this act through a showing by a clear and convincing evidence, the highest civil standard, the only higher standard is beyond a reasonable doubt, that a risk factor, accident, hazard, or other cause not associated with the firefighter's service was the dominant cause of listed disease. I'd submit for your consideration that is an impossible standard of proof. I just don't know how you would ever deny a claim under this. And it, particularly then, you have to wonder about the need, given that on the handout, the first sentence is, Wyoming workers' compensation already pays most current cancer claims. So the bill casts a net much, much broader than simply a few cancers, or in the case of the testicular cancer that the good sponsor alluded to at the beginning. And so it may be that this is unstoppable, as it has in the other states, because of our sympathy for these folks. But I would hazard to bet we'll be back here in 2 years, and 2 years after that, and 2 years after that, trying to figure out where are we going to get the money to pay for this.
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman. There's some talk of the sideboards on this, and I think most of the discussion of things like mental illness is really a red herring here. It's what we've created the medical commission and workers' comp to deal with, was to keep this from expanding out of reason. And to qualify another disease, the medical prescription has to prescribe by rule after verifiable research determines a dominant cause of the disease, illness, or health impairment, disability is or was employment as a firefighter. That's one of the sideboards to keep it expanding to other diseases that are not listed here. The second one is over on page 8 where you've got the standard procedure in workers' comp. What they would go through now is they've got the ability to go in and prove that a specific incident, and that hasn't gotten out of hand. That's what we use in workers' comp generally, and that's a safe procedure, as safe as anything can be in this sort of area. So I would submit that there are adequate protections here. I don't think the cost is going to get out of hand. And you're looking at basically very healthy people who are at known heightened risk, significantly heightened risk, of getting certain cancers from their occupation. And that's exactly what workers' comp is designed to deal with. And that's what we're talking about here. Madam Chairman, I urge adoption of the bill.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I kind of hate to weigh in on this at all, really, to tell the truth, but I've been thinking about it. You know, cancer is a really complicated thing, and you really can't say for certainty that something caused cancer. And if we were to take all of us in this room, we go through life, some of us will get cancer, some of us won't. Some of us may have it more than once. But honestly, you can search and search and search and try to figure out what caused it. You know that some things have higher risk factors for it. It's true. In the case of melanoma, for example, which I'm very familiar with, childhood exposure to sunbirds are like one of the real prevalent things. But occupationally, it's very, very difficult. And I've read a lot about it. There's a book called The Emperor of All Maladies, and it talks about how really difficult it is to determine what causes cancer, because it's a lifetime of mutations that happen. And you have to get the right combination of mutations for a cell to turn to cancer. And I'm just sitting here thinking, well, I bet there are cancers that are correlated with these brave people that fight fires. I'm confident of it. But that doesn't mean all cancers are caused by that. Some of them will have melanoma, just like I did, probably not caused by their firefighting experience. All of us in this room right now have different levels of cardiovascular disease. that just because you're a fireman, does that mean that somehow you're in a different set? I don't think the science is here, Madam Chairman, and I don't think it's a really good way for us to go. It's very, very open-ended, and I don't have a lot of confidence that some panel is going to be able to sort that out for workers' comp, because there's nobody in the nation, in the world, that's really sorted this out, Madam Chairman. If we knew what really causes cancer, we'd be a lot farther ahead, but we don't.
Further discussion on the bill? Mr. Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I appreciate the fact that we can't narrow down a specific cause in all cases, but the scientific community, Madam Chairman, can certainly do data analysis and cohort studies, look at historical incidences of different types of cancer based on occupation, and there's a wealth of literature. I pulled up some of it right here. Looking at massive cohort studies I see one from 1950 to 2009 talking about mortality and cancer incidence in pooled cohorts of U.S. firefighters from San Francisco, Chicago, and Philadelphia, indicating strong correlations with cancer. Here's a cancer risk among firefighters, a review and meta-analysis of 32 studies in JOEM back in 2006 from LeMasters et al., which indicates positive correlations of about six types of cancer where there's clear 95% confidence intervals for correlations. So while it is true that we cannot very clearly say your cancer was caused because of this incidence very often, the reality is the literature is robust and extensive when it comes to correlating increased incidence of cancer with firefighting. And there's even correlation in some of this data with the number of days on the job correlates to lung cancer. So there are strong correlative data available, and we can certainly produce some of this literature and distribute it to the chamber if necessary. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Further discussion? Senator Landon.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Great debate. And just to kind of finish it up, obviously if the bill moves forward, I think there's always room for work that we could do. Really appreciated the comments from our friend from Lander. He's absolutely correct. There's never going to be a time, Madam Chairman, that we can definitively say that the reason a firefighter got cancer was because he was a firefighter. But neither can we say that he didn't. We're never going to be able to assure ourselves 100%. The former mayor from the North Country is right, too. There's some cautions here. The case that he quoted where the cases ballooned up to 62, that was a great big city and the brother of love back there and millions of firefighters. Good reason why it went from 3 to 62. There was lots and lots of them. And in that regard, in my county, we dated back 25 years, 188 firefighters. And it all boiled down to maybe two might have had the opportunity to claim a presumptive case here. One of them, I outlined that story for you. So here in Wyoming, and the other thing this bill does, Madam Chairman, it does pull in our volunteers. The guys who aren't paid to do this. We lost 166 firefighters last year in the United States. One of those was up in Fremont County. It was not because of cancer. But we're asking these guys, volunteers, a lot of them, to stand out there on New Year's Eve on the main street of a western town in Wyoming, below zero temperatures, fighting a fire on a building where they stored a whole bunch of snow machines. And no telling what kinds of fumes come out of a building like that was 80 or 90 years old. We could talk an awful lot about what these guys face, and I appreciated the chairman bringing up the big box store syndrome. So many of the products nowadays, Madam Chairman, are built in far-off places on Pacific Rim locations somewhere. And we have no idea what's in them. And that's why you see the cancer rates being driven.
We can find some studies that say, well, we're not too sure, but we can find an awful lot of studies that say it's absolutely true. And so that's why the bill is in front of you. Appreciate the debate. I would encourage your support of the bill and move it through, and maybe we can work on it second reading. Thank you.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 89, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The bill has passed. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 158. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 158, Depositions by Telephone, an Act Relating to Evidence and Witnesses, sponsored by Senator Case, was referred to Committee Number 1, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Anselmi Dalton, Christensen, Hicks, Kinski, and Nethercott. Senator Christensen, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Madam Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable consideration on Senate File 158. To present that Senate file will be Senator Case.
Thank you, Senator Case.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. Senate File 158 is a permissive bill that allows the courts to determine and authorize a deposition to be taken remotely by communication over telephone or through other electronic means. It also authorizes, Madam Chairman, that if a remote deposition is authorized under this section, the court may also authorize the witness to be sworn in over telephone or through other electronic means if the officer or other person swearing in the witness is not in the same location as the witness. So, Madam Chairman, this deals with civil cases. It's the case where lawyers deponents have agreed to hold these depositions, and it allows for them to be held by telephone if the court agrees and puts it in their rules, and if, of course, the parties to the case agree. It's very permissive, doesn't require it, and what it would allow is the case where you have the deponent on one end of a telephone line and the questions being asked on the other, and the person, the court reporter, or whoever is going to do the swearing is on the line with the person asking the questions. I suppose possibly they could be somewhere else, but doesn't have to be in the same room. It saves costs in litigation. Some attorneys will appreciate this and use it. Some won't, but it is very permissive. And it's written to be permissive rather than prescriptive because we can't tell the courts what to do. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Case. Discussion on the bill. Senator Burns.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, is this the practice in other states right now, or are we pioneering a new legal ground?
Further discussion? Senator Case.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding is that the practice varies and that it's actually being done in Wyoming now. It does happen. But if you really carefully read and evaluate the court's rules, you know, they have different rules of court proceedings, and here's what our staff attorney said. From reading all of those together, it would appear to me under C that a stenographer would have to be in the location where the deponent is located. And however, the stenographer would not necessarily have to be the officer that is administering the oath, but they have to be in the same location according to our rules. That actually doesn't happen all the time in Wyoming, and this would allow the court to decide if they should clear that up. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Further discussion? Are you ready for the question?
Yes.
Question has been called. All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 158, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Senate File 158 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 154. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 154, Sex Offender Registration, Accessories, an Act Relating to Sex Offender Registration, sponsored by Senator Hastert, was referred to Committee Number 1, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Anselmi Dalton, Christensen, Hicks, Kinski, and Nethercott. Senator Christensen, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Christensen? Where are you? Your mic is on at that desk, if you want it.
Madam Chairman, I move that when the committee of the whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 154, and to present that Senate file will be Senator Hastert.
Thank you. Senator Hastert?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Chairwoman. Members of the Senate, I bring you Senate File 158 and ask for your favorable consideration. The sex offender registration accessory. This bill is just it's not a change. It's a clarification. Right now, the language exists, but it's been open to interpretation, and this just clarifies in the law that if you are convicted of being an accessory to a sexual assault, that you will end up on the registration, Madam Chairman. There was an issue in the northeastern part of the state that one of the co-sponsors that brought the bill to and asked for some assistance knew of an incident of an issue where an individual was convicted of accessory and was found guilty, and then due to some interpretations was pulled off the registration list. At that time, he was prevented from being a care provider for some children, but now then is back in that position. And so, Madam Chairman, this is, like I said, it's not a change. It's just tidying up a clarification of existing statutes just to ensure that we kind of closed the loophole in it. And that's the bill, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Hastert. And just a point of clarification, we are on Senate File 154. That's the bill that we're moved on. Is there any discussion? Are you ready for the question?
Yes.
All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 154, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The bill passes. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I know you meant to say passes Committee of the Whole. So.
Thank you. Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion is passed.
Report. Good job.
Will the reading clerk please read the Committee of the Whole report?
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under considerations bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 118, do pass. Senate File 122, do pass amended. Senate File 129, do pass. Senate File 115, do pass amended. Senate File 91, do pass amended. Senate File 132, do pass amended. Senate File 167, do pass amended. Senate File 151, do pass amended. Senate File 89, do pass amended. Senate File 158, do pass. Senate File 154, do pass. Senator Ellis, Madam Chairman.
Senator Ellis.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
Oh, you heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Committee of the Whole report has been adopted. Do we have standing committee reports or messages from the House?
January 30, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number 9, to whom was referred Senate File 117, Nationwide Multi-State Licensing System Collection Agencies, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Anderson, Coe, Perkins, Rothfuss, and Von Flatern. Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
Message from the House? None? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, I believe that clears the desk.
Mr. President, in that case, I move that we stand adjourned until 10 a.m. Tuesday, January the 31st.
Announcement, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet tomorrow, Tuesday, January 31st, 30 minutes afternoon recess, in the Jonah Room L54, that's the larger room, to pick up Senate File 83, State Spending and Revenues Public Reports, Senate File 131, State Revenues and Expenditure Review, and Senate File 95, Early Retirement, in that order.
Senator Coe.
Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, not only is going to meet in the morning at 8, but we're going to meet tomorrow afternoon on adjournment in Jonah Room S19 to take up Senate File 145, UW and Community College Boards of Trustee Chairman, Senate File 152, Hathaway Student Scholarships, and Senate File 146, Community College District Board Voting. One other announcement for those that are interested and want to go over and hear a presentation on House Bill 236, School Finance Omnibus Education Funding. That's tonight, 6 o'clock, across the street at East High School Auditorium.
Senator Emmert.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 6, Travel, will meet tomorrow morning, 8 a.m., Jonah Room, S27, to consider Senate File 139, Game and Fish Licenses, Senate File 169, Migratory Bird Refuge.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, Transportation, your committee number 8, will meet at 4:30 in Jonah Room S27 to consider the following bills. Senate File 140, I-80 Master Plan. Senate File 57, Motor Vehicle Franchises Exception.
Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, the your committee number 2, Appropriations, will be meeting as soon as we possibly can down at Appropriations to finish up Senate File 166, the Capital Construction Bill, and then immediately upon finishing that, we will meet with our fellow appropriation members from the other end of the building to finish up, hopefully finish up round robin.
Any other announcements? Senator Dockstader.
President, privilege of the floor.
You may.
Mr. President, we have our university tonight, University of Wyoming, is wrestling Boise State. And the interesting part about it, it's not in Boise. It's not in Laramie. They're wrestling at Star Valley High School. And the event is being broadcast, compliments of 5 high-def color cameras, with a local media company from that part of the state.
Woo-hoo.
Two professional announcers carrying that live to what we presume to be several thousand people. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that, Senator Dockstader. Any other announcements? You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Senate stands adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, January 31st.